Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report with me, John Iderola, still under lockdown, but joining me in that lockdown situation, Michael Shore. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. You know, we don't officially have a lockdown, John. This is just safer at home. Lockdown is what they have in the countries where it worked.
Exactly. We have loose suggestions, basically.
Right.
Even that gone in many places. I just want to put this out here before we start, while we're talking about the pandemic. I believe that I am getting sick. There's a very good chance that I will be coughing at some point. I am sure that it is just regular coughing, everyone. So let's not have everyone freak out if I start coughing.
How are you sure? Because you have no other symptom that's on a checklist of 1,000?
Yeah, and also because, you know, it's nicer to imagine things are going to turn out okay. No, I have no reason to believe. I literally just started coughing this morning. I'm sure that it is not coronavirus. It is likely just the natural consequence of treating your body like a toxic waste dump.
No, understood.
Exactly. But I'm glad to have you here. And
I'm glad to be.
Through the course of this hour, we're going to be talking about quite a bit. We've been asserting for some time that if the government had been a little bit more on the spot with recommendations to states to shut down, that could have potentially saved lives. And now models are apparently showing that. We're going to have some of those numbers. We're going to have an inside view from Donald Trump's intelligence briefings. We're going to find out a little bit more about how those have been run recently. Updated unemployment numbers, and the right has a view, a competitor to the View that they're going to be launching. And I think the first episode's actually available. So we're going to have a little trailer for that. Should be fun. In a dark comedy sort of sense. And before we get into all that, though, I did want to let you know. So some of you might have already been watching the show on the Twitch streaming platform up until now. Well, we are launching more content. TYT is coming to Twitch at long last. In addition to the Young Turks and the Damage Report, which will be available at twitch.com/TYT, you can also watch Staying Home with Josh Fox, The Conversation, Old School, and Happy Half Hour. And that's just the beginning. We're going to have additional shows as well. Jenk is going to have this interview show that he's going to be doing there. So that should be a lot of fun. And you can go to twitch.com/TYT and start following TYT there to get notifications when the stream goes live. And some of you might already be there right now, actually. And so if you're watching there, thank you. If you're on YouTube, thank you as always. Please send in your super chats and we'll respond to them. And hit the like button so more people know that the stream is now active. And with that, Michael, what do you say we jump into some news?
Let's do it. I mean, I've been waiting for us to come to Twitch, so that's kind of cool.
There you go. I know that you already spend so much of your time at Twitch.
Right.
And I'm sure.
Right.
Well, actually, your son probably does. He probably talks
to
Twitch.
He probably does,
people.
And I don't even know about it. Yet.
Yeah, maybe he's commenting. I do, actually. I used to Twitch years and years ago and then stopped because at some point I realized there needs to be a few consecutive minutes each day where I'm not live on video. So anyway, those minutes are not these minutes. These minutes are the news, so let's talk about it. We've known that the government did not follow warnings early on about how severe the pandemic was likely to be, and it seems clear that that had to have cost lives, that the catastrophic 90,000-plus and counting dead in America from coronavirus could have been much lower. But how much lower? New research is showing that it could have been quite a bit, actually. So I want to talk about the results of a Columbia University study that believes that if the U.S. had begun imposing social distancing measures 1 week earlier than it did back in March, about 36,000 fewer people would have died in the coronavirus outbreak. And I want to show you a little bit of a map here of what it could have looked like in different areas. So, you know, it still would have been rough in New York and New Jersey, that area, but a lot, not nearly as bad. And you can see just the spread across particularly the eastern half of the U.S. would have been significantly constrained, that it would have stayed largely in the cities in those states and not spread to so many smaller towns, as you can see on the actual situation that happened on the left hand of that. Michael, thoughts?
Well, I mean, this is not going to be the front of Ron DeSantis's Christmas card. If you look at the southeastern United States there, you can see what was avoidable in many cases, and, and how devastating that was as well. And I think Florida, he's the governor of Florida. When you look at what happened with Florida, that they allowed things to go on for so much longer, I think that's one of the places that you look at and you say, man, they should have done more. And I think they know that.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, we're looking at there, like, look, some of that could have come from New York or other areas or directly from international travel or something like that. But there's every reason to believe that quite a bit of it started in Florida and then spread. I remember very early on when we were talking about kids continuing to go to Florida for spring break. And then at the University of Texas Austin, where I went to grad school, they had cases that they traced back to kids participating in spring break. And so, yeah, if New York had shut down a little bit earlier, if Florida had shut down a little bit earlier, it would have been lower. It wouldn't have been nothing, obviously, because...
Of course not.
Yeah. I mean, so many people already had it and we just didn't know it, partially because it took forever to begin actual testing. But it could have been lower. And that, by the way, that is 1 week earlier. 36,000.
Right, just 1 week. Two is devastating.
Exactly. Yeah, let's look at that number then. So if we had begun locking down cities and limiting social contact back on March 1st, 2 weeks earlier than most people started staying home, and that's largely what happened here in LA. We started earlier than a little bit of the country, but not anywhere near March 1st, then the majority of the deaths, about 83%, would have been avoided. 54,000 fewer people. So if we had started social distancing 2 weeks earlier, a Vietnam War of deaths could have been avoided, and likely we wouldn't have had to stay in quarantine for quite as long. It's entirely possible that some of the economic damage from long-term necessitated social distancing could have been limited had we started earlier.
Yeah, that's clear. I think also what you have to look at, not just who could have done better, but who did well. I mean, you mentioned Los Angeles, but London Breed, the mayor of San Francisco, she was really the first that I remember. I'm not researching this as I speak, but the first, as I remember, to close down her city, to go into that stay at home, close down businesses. And people thought, what is she thinking? And in fact, she was so far ahead of the curve that you can see in this Columbia University model that she probably single-handedly saved a ton of lives in San Francisco.
Yeah, it's entirely possible that we could have had, like potentially we saw spreading from New York and New Jersey and possibly spreading from Florida, a similar thing on the West Coast, possibly even affecting LA more. And that might have been avoided. And so, look, I want to say I've been critical since the very beginning, obviously, of the Trump's response. This is not just about the federal government. This is not just about Trump. Hypothetically, governors and mayors, like you're giving credit to a mayor who did the right thing. There are mayors and governors who did the wrong thing. It is entirely possible that if Cuomo or de Blasio had taken more aggressive action, that could have limited it. Now, regardless of what individual mayors or governors did, more assistance from the federal government, either in, you know, dollars and things like that, but also just guidance, would have been great, because Cuomo and de Blasio don't have access to the intelligence briefings that Donald Trump had been having for something like 6 weeks at that point about this. They could still have acted earlier, and I think it's entirely justifiable to provide some of the criticism to them, but the federal government should have been leaders on this. And so if anyone is most to blame, it is clearly the president. The buck has to stop somewhere, whether he takes responsibility or not.
You can contrast the president with the governor, right? I mean, yes, I don't think there's a great deal of disagreement over the fact that the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, and that state waited too long to take action. But when they saw that what was going on, they took admirable action. They took swift and decisive action. So they did learn a lesson in the short term that allowed them to save lives going forward. The White House, the federal government, had the same material with which to learn that lesson and didn't. And they just kept waffling all the way along to this very day. And so I think that you have to also, even though you can be critical, you have to give credit to the fact that, okay, we may have dropped the ball early, but we are going to carry the ball and we are going to save our people as we can. And they've done, you know, in large part, not perfectly, obviously, nobody has, what they can, because they responded to the information they had. The federal government has not.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I'm gonna read you a couple of little touchstones from the experience we had over the past few months. And if you watch the show, you might remember some of these. After Italy and South Korea had started aggressively responding to the virus back earlier this year, President Trump resisted canceling campaign rallies or telling people to stay home or avoid crowds. The risk of the virus to most Americans was very low, he said. Yeah, he still in mid-March was having campaign rallies, telling people just stay calm, it's gonna be fine. He had the interview on Fox News where he said, you know, a lot of people get it and they'll just go to work and it'll be fine and whatever. That was what he was saying in mid-March, long after he knew that that was a horrible idea. He was tweeting things like, this is March 9th. Again, tens of thousands of lives could have been saved if even after this tweet he had taken it seriously. So last year, 37,000 Americans died from the common flu. It averages between 27 and 70,000 per year. Nothing is shut down. Life in the economy go on. At this moment, there are 546 confirmed cases of coronavirus with 22 deaths. Think about that. Yeah, think about that. That's how many confirmed cases there were, because again, we weren't testing virtually anyone. It is now believed that there were tens of thousands of cases going undiagnosed already at that point. And just days, day after day after day after day was being wasted with him wanting to keep going to his rallies and watching sports and stuff like that. And so it continued to spread.
Yeah. And I think also an important part of that is this comparison to the flu thing, right? I mean, so if 37,000 people did indeed die of the flu last year, and I don't know that number to be true, and I'm now even more dubious of because where it comes from, but let's say that's the operative number, and you find out that there is another flu that we need to act upon, that's still 37,000 people, and the White House just sat on its hand. Even when they put this task force together, which postdates this, they put the task force together, and you had smart voices in the room saying you had to do these things, and they still drag their feet on that. It's an astonishing set of circumstances, considering the information at hand and considering how other people who, when they finally had access to that information, the way that they acted and saved lives.
Yeah. And look, I'm glad that this information is getting out there. This is one attempt to model it. It's possible others will come, and nothing is definitive. Like they say, you know, there's no way we can point to a particular individual and say that this person would have lived had we done this earlier. We're talking about raw numbers, but we do need this sort of information. And so I'm glad that it's out there. I'm glad that the media is covering it. And I can only assume that within the next hour or so, something big is going to happen with Michael Flynn or something, so that some networks don't have to cover this later on today. There will be a gate opening with some president's name on it. I don't know exactly what it'll be. Neither will Trump, but I have a feeling he'll be tweeting about it soon.
Yeah, there's no question.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Donald Trump has attempted to parry criticisms that he didn't act quickly enough on the coronavirus pandemic by saying that early intelligence briefings weren't specific enough, or they made it out to be less of a big deal than it turned out to be, which has obviously been disputed by a number of individuals. But I want to talk a little bit about those intelligence briefings, how they're run, and the odds that anyone trying to get him to grasp the seriousness would be able to do that. So Mr. Trump, who has mounted a years-long attack on the intelligence agencies that continues to this day, is particularly difficult to brief on critical national security matters, according to interviews with 10 current and former intelligence officials familiar with his intelligence briefings. And they're going to give us some information about what it's like to try to get through to this person. And hold on to your butts, because this gets rough. The president veers off on tangents, and getting him back on topic is difficult, they said. He has a short attention span and rarely, if ever, reads intelligence reports, relying instead on conservative media and his friends for information. Who needs intelligence agencies when you got your buds? He's unashamed to interrupt intelligence officers and riff based on tips or gossip he hears from the former casino owner Steve Wynn, golfers Gary Player, Christopher Ruddy, conservative media executives. So that's the first course here. Is that he doesn't prep for the meetings, and he doesn't seem to think that all of the intelligence that agencies staffed by thousands of career professionals, that all of what they come up with can't possibly compare in import to what some athlete told him on the phone last night.
Yeah, and this is a narrative, John, that dates back to when he was a candidate. When you're the nominee of the party, the president, the sitting president, can approve you to get the intelligence briefings, which the Obama administration did. He was getting intelligence briefings, and even at that time, when these were new to him, he wasn't spending much time with them. He had, if you recall, when he came into office, even a sort of built-in skepticism about the intelligence community that manifested itself in several ways in terms of turnover, staff turnover and whatnot. And then as president, this has been the running narrative. What you're reading now in detail has also been reported by the Washington Post in great detail. It was reported during the Mueller hearings in great detail. This is a president who is ambivalent about the most important reports. His vice president gets them. Joe Biden said that he, you know, as a candidate now, is saying that when he was vice president, he read them every day and the president would ask his counsel once in a while on them. Yeah. These are, you know, this is presidenting 101.
Yeah. and it's, look, you talked about his suspicion before he'd even gotten in there, and all of the deep state stuff since then has been convenient for the right wing, but has also, I'm sure, increased his lack of regard for what any of these people say. And the thing is, yeah, like, no, you shouldn't just blanket believe anything they come up with. They can be wrong, obviously. And, you know, people point to, like, the run-up to the war with Iraq, which I personally feel is much less an issue of the actual intelligence and much more the politicians picking and choosing what they want from the intelligence. I don't think it's actually as much of an indictment of the CIA as of the politicians. But sure, be critical. But also, don't necessarily elect someone who is the perfect manifestation of the multi-decades-long war by the right on any form of expertise or learning or anything.
Right. There's little, John, I want to comment on what you just said, though. There's little that you can do about what someone who's in the White House does with the intelligence, but you want them to have the intelligence. So you go back to the Bush White House, and we despised what they were doing with the intelligence they were getting, but we knew, we didn't even think about it. They were using these intelligence briefings and taking from it what they would in their own way of distilling it. This guy isn't even looking at the intelligence, and he's getting it on a golf course from a former golf pro. It's unbelievable to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're going to get your intelligence on the golf course, at least go to Michael Jordan. Anyway, okay, so let's go. Because Donald Trump...
It's all sports with you.
It is. I'm a sports fanatic. Okay, let's jump back into a little bit more of what these officials have said. Mr. Trump rarely absorbs information that he disagrees with or that runs counter to his worldview. I would say that that's largely true of an increasing number of Americans these days, but it's most consequential with him. Briefing him has been so great a challenge compared with his predecessors that the intelligence agencies have hired outside consultants to study how better to present information to him. And they've had to go through multiple briefers because at least one was burned out from the effort of trying to cram a minimal amount of information into his incredibly stubborn head.
This isn't defending anybody, but I understand how the people that would put these reports together would want to tailor it to their audience. But it's what's so pathetic about it is that your audience is the president of the United States, who doesn't have the attention span for the intelligence briefing. So they're trying to make this as simple. They're trying to give him a Cliff Notes version. And maybe there's a maybe that's an arcane way of saying it, but I don't know what the new Cliff Notes is because I haven't seen it in my son's room yet. It's online. But in any case,
I get the reference.
You get the reference. Thanks, John. But that's what's the most indicting part of this is that you have to tailor it to someone who couldn't care less, it seems.
Yeah. Now, I want to be fair, and we're not simply going to read the sections of this that are critical of Donald Trump. Let's give you the response from someone who believes that this is an inaccurate characterization of Donald Trump. White House officials disputed it, saying, quote, "The president is laser focused on the issues at hand and asks probing questions throughout the briefings. It reminds me of appearing before a well-prepared appellate judge and defending the case," according to National Security Advisor Robert C. Bryan. And others say that he asks very incisive questions and he has an understanding. None of them dispute that he doesn't read anything and he doesn't prep,
right,
but that he asked very good questions. And so I just wanted to go very briefly to, I don't want to show a bunch of what he said yesterday in his televised meeting. I want to show you just a few seconds of video of Donald Trump, just a little taste of the probing questions and analysis that he brings to this sort of thing.
And you know, when you say per capita, there's many per capitas, it's like per capita relative to what, but you can look at just about
it. When you say per capita, there's many per capitas. Per capita to what? No.
Right.
No, the per capita is the to what? It's right. To the it's, capita. It's,
that's what makes it relative. Is
that's
per capita.
The relative thing.
Yeah. Right.
Well,
it's good to know that he'll be good before a judge, I guess, if you're a Trump supporter.
Exactly. Does he not know what that means?
Yeah.
He's 90 years old. Does he not know what per cap? Is that why he keeps saying things about our testing that are untrue, that he fundamentally doesn't understand what per capita is a reference to?
Well, that's interesting that he just is clueless about it. So that explains everything that we're going through right now. I think that when he doesn't know what he does, when he doesn't know something, he just fumbles around until it's over and then moves on. It's a tactic that, you know, other presidents have used, except they know what they're talking about. They just need to move and maneuver away from what it is. Yeah. Not all of them, but certainly you've seen them do it, John. And yeah, this is just ridiculous. But that's the kind of question he's asking. If he's asking those questions in an intelligence briefing, man, maybe it's better. Maybe it is better. I don't know.
If Obama had said that quote, that's it. That would have been it over and over and over again. I'm never going to play it again because there's going to be worse stuff tomorrow. Really fast,
although
though.
People wouldn't be paying as close attention.
Yeah, possibly, because the pandemic probably wouldn't have been nearly as bad.
Right.
So I wanted to find out what he meant there, and the video cuts off. So I went to the actual transcript of that meeting, and he says, and you know, when you say per capita, there's many per capitas. It's like per capita relative to what? But you can look at just about any category, and we're really at the top, meaning positive on a per capita basis too. He used it there as if he knows what it means, by the way.
Right.
They've done a great job. And he's really fast, because he's talking about testing there. So I decided, because I gave credit to the rise in testing recently, a few days ago, I wanted to give credit, and if all of a sudden we're doing really well per capita as well, whatever that means, I wanted to give credit there. And so I looked it up, and these numbers are accurate as of yesterday. And I know it's small, but you can see there that the USA is down, it's fourth from the bottom there. No, we're not right at the top per capita. Just say we're doing better. And we're doing better despite the fact that Donald Trump isn't doing anything to make those daily testing numbers go up, but that we are going up. But we're not at the top on a per capita basis. Stop lying about things that are easily checkable. I found that within seconds.
But John, per capita relative to what?
That's a good, probably elevation, I think. Jesus Christ.
Right.
Anyway, let's go to one more of the bits of a look into what he does. And this, what he does in those meetings, they say he doesn't appear to read the document or to otherwise prepare, and he constantly asks, how do you know? Common refrain. He counters with his own statistics on issues where he has strong views, like trade or NATO. Strong views, by the way, not a grasp of the facts. He just has strong views. Directly challenging him, even when his numbers are wrong, appears to erode his trust, and ultimately he stops listening. So it's one thing to be ignorant, to not have the information. But when you are surrounded by people whose job it is to make sure that you have an accurate understanding of what's going on, when they correct you and you just tune it out or start to trust them less when they're right. Them being right makes you trust them less. That is about as corrosive a worldview, a perspective with which to govern from that I can imagine.
Right. It also points to this deep-seated distrust he has of the intelligence community. Yeah. Once again, I mean, they say, how do you know? Well, here's how they know. It's their job to know, and they're not going to share anything that they don't know, because they are part of the intelligence community who they get up every day to know and share with you at the highest levels of world government what they know. And I think that you can see it in that example that you pointed out, that this is a man who is just permanently skeptical of anyone in the intelligence community who thinks he knows better than everyone in the room.
Yeah. By the way, really fast, I'm seeing comments like per capita from the standpoint of water. I think he thinks per capita means just in the capitals of different states. That's possible. Someone said,
yeah, in Tallahassee, we're doing great.
Exactly. Ernie put in a comment saying, Dunning-Kruger effect, that's all I'm going to say. Yeah, it's a perfect demonstration of, if you could do an entire textbook on the Dunning-Kruger effect just with case studies of Donald Trump. Another Thursday brings another update to the unemployment number, which has been rising rapidly during the pandemic. That's another 2.4 million workers filed for jobless benefits last week, according to government reporting, bringing the total of new claims to more than 38 million in just 9 weeks. And you can see here what those past few weeks have brought. That chart is now unreadable in any way, especially in mobile, because of the effect of the last 2 months or so. And yeah. So the new claims are they're lower than we've had in recent weeks, so that's good, but they're probably lower because so many people have been fired that they have been brought into the system over the past 2 months. So yeah. Still horrid numbers.
Yeah, when you look at them, I mean, you look at what this administration has done, that one disease, I shouldn't say this administration, that this pandemic has done to Obama's strong job numbers, it's astonishing.
Yeah, it just...
See what I did, John? Do you see what I just did?
I was trying to move on.
Glossed over it.
Yeah.
You want to talk about sports again?
I do. You know what I'm curious, though, is when we see these unemployment numbers, per capita relative to what? That's what I would ask. Anyway, yeah.
But the serious side of this for 1 second is what the plan can be to get these people back to work, because it's not just going to happen with the end of the pandemic. And that is going to be the crux. You know, the president loves talking about the stock market when he talks about the economy. Voters don't talk about the stock market. They talk about jobs. And that's what the president is up against in this campaign now, is that he is going to have to create language that explains what's going to happen here. It's becoming increasingly difficult for him to do it. And you see it in the national numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you look at that, like 38.6 million, yeah. Think about sitting down with any random one of those individuals and hearing
you
about...
You are, actually.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Okay, so think about speaking to another one. And what that looks like, and the fear and uncertainty you must have about even the near future, let alone the long-term effects of that. And it's just piled up tens of millions of people. And so... it's possible that this was unavoidable, that if you're going to have, you know, shelter at home orders across the country for even the couple of months that we did, that this was going to be unavoidable. What you can do, though, is help those people. And, mm-hmm. You know, everybody theoretically got $1,200, although I know a lot of people have not. I never did. I never got anything. But anyway, supposedly some people did. That was a one-time thing. So great. They should be good for the next year or so. What you did have was the enhanced unemployment benefits. That was one of the best things targeted at the non-billionaire class that they've done. And so, of course, as these numbers continue to go up, the unemployment numbers, there are apparently few plans to continue that. And in particular, Donald Trump, remember, right-wing populist, he reportedly opposes extending the weekly $600 boost in unemployment benefits past July 31st, citing three officials familiar with the remarks. The Washington Post reported on Tuesday that Trump expressed the opposition at a private lunch for Senate Republicans. So again, the one thing helping regular people who are hurting the most economically from this, and remember, all the Republicans are saying every day, Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, all they're saying is, we have to end the lockdowns because people are hurting economically. What, increased unemployment benefits? No, we got to get rid of that. That's too expensive.
Right.
Screw
right.
them. screw them for losing their jobs. They can die in the streets. I don't care. And Trump is right there with him. The populist guy, no. Cut off the one benefit. We need to get immunity for businesses who might be sued by their workers. That's what we need. Again, populist.
Yeah, right. And there's no original thinking coming out of the federal government or from leadership. But, you know, there is a conservative, Josh Hawley, the conservative senator from Missouri who beat Claire McCaskill last time out, is talking about taking paychecks and having the government honor some of those paychecks at a certain percentage. Mm-hmm. And you're getting ideas. They're not all fluid and they're not all good. And even that is terribly flawed and geared toward business as well. But I will say that the thinking around it is just so black and white. Let's stop these benefits. Let's get these benefits going. There's no nuance to it at all. And I think that that's going to hurt the president. You ask what people are fearful of. Anecdotally, I know that the fear is, when are people going to start hiring again, right? People don't know that. And there is no kind of guidance coming from the federal government on this. I blame Democrats as well for this, but there are no answers either. But there isn't even a system in place to help people understand that or hold their hands through it financially. And that's going to hurt the president.
Yeah. And as of right now, that path he's traveling down, he does have allies. Mitch McConnell promised House Republicans on Wednesday that the beefed up unemployment benefits enacted earlier this spring will not be in the next bill. He says, you know, he just wants to like wait and see what happens with the spending that's already been allocated. Yeah. And he says more aid may be necessary. He doesn't say specifically to who there, but he said that the $600 weekly boost in unemployment benefits won't continue. He's made that vow previously. So the two most powerful Republicans in D.C. apparently agree that was a thing that we did for a limited time, and we're not going to do that. We're not going to do, you know, weekly, you know, UBI or anything like that. Regular people are just out. Because the thing is, like, what we were talking before about trying to imagine the personal anguish of each individual that's lost their job. If you care about the workers, 38 million more unemployed is a devastating thing. But when you look at it from the point of view of business, having tens of millions of Americans that are desperate for literally any job at any level of pay or lack of benefits, that's not the worst thing that you could imagine coming out of this. And after all, they do want the economy to come back, but not just any kind of economy. There's particular types, particular formulations that they would really prefer. And this pandemic, while it's been devastating for some people, theoretically, if you're trying to gobble up real estate, or if you're trying to get workers at much lower levels of pay, not the worst thing in the world that's ever happened to you in your business plan.
No, but most businesses rely on the ability of the American people to spend money, too. And if you don't have that, then you're in a really precarious situation, even as a business person, which does the playing field's never level. Right. We know that. But it does help to level it somewhat. It works toward level, but it's not ever going to be level.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. That's true. Donald Trump swears that he's been taking hydroxychloroquine, but apparently not for much longer. He said yesterday, "I think the regimen finishes in a day or two." Yeah, I think it's 2 days. 2 days. Because he totally takes it. It would be stupid if he did, but he totally does. It's done in 2 days. He's going to finish up in 2 days. The thing that he takes, he totally takes it. Anyway, the thing is, while Donald Trump is likely lying about taking a potentially harmful medicine that doesn't treat a disease that he doesn't have, others are taking it. And it has become sort of it's like a virtue signal by pill, I guess. On Tuesday, talk radio host and former Trump White House advisor Sebastian Gorka went further than Trump, announcing that he had been taking the drug in an attempt to avoid contracting COVID-19 for a month and posting a picture on his prescription bottle. Is it the miracle solution? Well, I don't know, since there's apparently no evidence that it cures it, and there's definitely no evidence that it prevents it. But he is taking it, and he's not the only one. I'm curious if you have any information about this individual, Michael. Representative Roger Marshall, a doctor and Kansas Senate candidate, said Tuesday that he and several family members are taking hydroxychloroquine in an attempt to ward off the virus. And again, there's no evidence that it wards off the virus.
No, Roger Marshall's a cool-looking guy, but it ends right there. I don't know frankly, enough about why he'd be taking hydroxychloroquine. But, you know, this is we since the Jonestown massacre in the late 70s, people, the term drinking the Kool-Aid has been part of the vernacular. This is drinking the Kool-Aid. There are people that hear what the president's saying. And this is why it's so dangerous. This is why Lysol, when you go onto their website, tells you not to ingest it.
Yes.
This is why Clorox does the same thing, because people are morons. Now, there is also a desperation thing, which none of these people, like Gorka, like Marshall, like the president, should be susceptible to. I just watched An American Experience, which is the long-running PBS documentary series. This one was from 1997. It was about the 1918 pandemic, which the president continues to call the 1917 pandemic. But this was about the 1918 pandemic. And of course, people were taking mixes of teas and castor oil and you know, mashed up aspirin and salicylic acid and all these things to try and use it to ward off the influenza at that time.
Yeah,
people are going to do that. This is so different because there is intelligence about this drug, and the intelligence tells us don't take it for this.
Yeah, and doctors are trying. They're trying to tell people not to, but that has been countered by, you know, Trump, who is one of the most admired figures in American politics. Lots of people will do what he says he's doing. And so they're taking it. And then you've got the Gorkas and all of that. But we've got even more. It's spreading because it's one thing to want to believe that this treats it, which apparently it doesn't, then to say, well, it probably wards it off, even though that doesn't even appear to be being tested at this point. Certainly no results have come out on that. But what if, in true snake oil fashion, it just treated everything? Well, we've got about a bit of that. So Michael Kudry, who is a sort of extremist fringe right-wing activist that, of course, Donald Trump has retweeted before, tweeted that he's been taking it for the past month with no side effects. Actually, he feels great, and he feels like he has increased energy and higher mental clarity. His face is very plush and vibrant, likely because of the drug. So it also just, it's just generally a tonic that'll cure what ails you, everything. It makes you feel better. And look, it's one thing for some crazy on Twitter. What about a crazy on the news? Like Sean Hannity, who had this caller on his show. I heard about it on your show, Laura's show. I thought to myself, whoa. I asked my doctor about it, asked if I could try it. I could only afford half a prescription. He said, don't be impatient. You have to take it a while. Within 2 weeks, Sean, for the first time in 30 years, I was able to stand up straight in the morning. That's not a thing that it should help with. But Hannity was not put off by that, saying, wow, that's great. And the drug's been around for 65 years, tens of millions of doses. Best doctor on this is at Cedars-Sinai. He said the risk is nil. Now, the thing is, even if there is a doctor at Cedars-Sinai that says the risk is nil, that doesn't make the risk nil. There's risk to your health, to your sanity, apparently, since it can cause hallucinations and things like that, paranoia, and also could kill you. But Sean Hannity, yeah, who continually says it can't kill you, is having people call in and say that it makes your feet stop hurting and your hair grow faster.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what these are. And it's snake oil to people who don't need it. And there are people, of course, that do need it.
Yes.
But there's a reason that you haven't seen Dr. Fauci at one of these press conferences since May 4th. He's not been there since May 4th, which indicates, again, I mean, this is a continuing theme, right? This is the president distrusting intelligence. This is somebody who is on a task force. He's the head of the National Institutes of Health. This is the person you would want to trust because they do have the intelligence. But the president goes right ahead,
yeah,
takes this medicine, even though we don't believe he's really taking it, but says you should. And of course, they talk about the detriments being nil, but they also don't talk about the fact that the benefits are also virtually nil. So
exactly. Or could come, but haven't been demonstrated yet. And that is not going to put these people off. So much so, like when I say that, like, it's, you alluded to the Kool-Aid, when I say it's like a badge of honor to say I'm taking this thing that has a high risk of injuring me, that has a potentially no upside, other drugs that apparently have shown some promise in treating it, the cult of hydroxychloroquine are attacking those other drugs. So it went from, we just want there to be something, to now, it has to be this. Don't talk to me about other drugs that might actually treat this. Which is insane. The only thing more insane, possibly, is that it's gone now from them saying they take it to inspiring callers to take it, and now saying that it treats everything, basically. We have this. Daily Beast is reporting that members of a pro-Trump QAnon conspiracy theory, these QAnoners, have a home recipe for hydroxychloroquine that consists of steeping various fruit rinds. While the recipe's proponents claim that it would help people avoid big pharma fillers, the fruit suggested in the recipe, like grapefruit, could react dangerously with other medications. So they're making their own hydroxychloroquine.
Right. Well, that's what people did in the pandemic. That's what I was talking about. And that's always going to happen on the fringes. The problem is the fringes used to operate on the fringes, right? Now the fringes will tweet it out. Now they'll have a following. Now they'll have social media. And the fringes grow and grow. And that's the danger that the president flaunts all the time when he does these things.
Yeah. So this is one more step to what we'd said earlier, that they're taking something that isn't hydroxychloroquine that doesn't treat the thing that they don't have.
Right.
But we're fake news, Michael.
Right. We're fake news. And why would you pay attention to the intelligence reports when they tell us that this isn't true?
Exactly. Millions of Americans have been led to believe that hydroxychloroquine will either treat coronavirus or stop them from getting it. And why wouldn't they believe that? The president says that he's been taking it to ward off ever getting it. The thing is, it doesn't actually ward it off. And that has come as a shock to some individuals, like this woman.
Fever was very high.
Kim, who doesn't want to show her face or full name, has lupus. She's taken hydroxychloroquine for 19 years to help with the pain. When she started feeling sick last month, her doctor prescribed antibiotics, but her condition quickly worsened. She tested positive at an urgent care for coronavirus.
When they gave me the diagnosis, I felt like it was a death sentence.
A week on oxygen and receiving plasma.
I'm like, how can I be sick? How? I'm on hydroxychloroquine. And they're like, well, nobody's ever said that was the cure.
A lot of good things have come out about the hydroxy. A lot of good things have come out. And you'd be surprised at how many people are taking it, especially the frontline workers.
Protect from the virus.
Kind of makes me mad that he thinks that it's going to do that.
So look, I don't know a lot about that woman. I don't know what her overall view of Donald Trump is. She was supposed to be taking the hydroxychloroquine, which most of the people we're talking about are not supposed to take it. And she says that she had been socially distancing, not going out and all of that. So she did seem to take coronavirus very seriously. Just in this one area, she was badly misled.
Yeah. And unlike the president, I believe this woman was taking hydroxychloroquine.
Yes. Well, she showed the bottle. That's more than we've gotten out of Donald Trump so far.
That's true.
Yeah. And it's a reminder, by the way, as you said, there are a lot of people who are supposed to take this, again, risky medicine, because it is better than just letting the conditions they have, like lupus, run rampant through their system. And there were supply chain issues with it before, when Fox started to push hydroxychloroquine. I hope that those have been resolved. But more and more people taking it, it potentially could imperil the access for people who need it. And I have to assume that if on, 4chan and stuff like that, QAnoners are brewing up their own hydroxychloroquine, probably a lot of that is because they're having trouble getting it. And so it is possible that those supply issues continue. And so...
Well, yeah, they don't want the big pharma fillers either, so...
That's true. And it's probably cheaper, I would imagine. I imagine that the price has been jacked up quite a bit.
Yeah.
But anyway, misinformation is damaging. Now, this woman was already going to be taking it, but she had been led to believe that it would protect her, that it would ward it off. And honestly, I don't know if it's, 0.1% or 3% of the country now believes that, but it isn't zero. And what we need is for people to get the right information. And they're not doing that. As you pointed out, Fauci's now out. He's not doing those press conferences anymore. And so who are people getting this information from? Donald Trump or Sebastian Gorka or Tucker Carlson or whatever, and that could have deadly consequences. Supposedly, the left has the view. I have an issue with that characterization, but that's what Trump seems to believe. So his campaign is coming up with an alternative to balance things out. It's the right view.
Wednesday just got better because the ladies are live, discussing the hottest topics of the week with you tonight.
And we will make
America great again.
Okay, so that's a little trailer for The Right View, which will be a once-a-week nightly show. So format-wise, it's missing the mark a little bit on The View. But you saw there that it's going to feature the president's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, former Fox News pundit and aspiring Trump herself, Kimberly Guilfoyle, senior campaign advisors Katrina Pearson and Mercedes Schlapp. So at long last, there will be balance in the force, Michael.
Yeah, no. There's been a clamoring, and I'm so relieved to know that this is going to be on once a week. First of all, this operates under the premises that the View is left wing. There are people certainly from the left, and it has become more pronounced since the guy in the White House is in the White House. But from day one, they've always had somebody who has stirred the pot, whether it be Debbie Matenopoulos or Elizabeth Hasselbeck. Mm-hmm. So this is a show that has always employed some differences of opinion, whereas the show that's going to be on here, The Right View, that no one's going to watch except people who never mind, nobody's going to watch it. that they're going to be all the same patina of face and belief.
Yeah. I mean, just the idea, like, The View is supposed to be that they disagree or whatever. That's supposed to be the point. That's what makes it exciting or whatever. The Right View is sort of stating that, oh, we have won, and it's correct. There's not going to be disagreement.
That's true.
They're either related to or get paid by Donald Trump. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of free critical thought, a lot of big ideas being explored on The Right View.
And they were so excited. You can imagine how excited they were when they came up with the title, because – you know what? It means two things. It's the view from the right, but it's also the correct view.
Yeah.
It's
very clever.
Wow.
Yeah. And look, I'm sure they're excited to be on TV. I mean, there's every reason to believe that this is that this show will eventually end up being on Trump TV. If blessedly Donald Trump loses in November, this will be one of their programs. My biggest issue with it is what you said. It's the idea that they really do think that The View is like, it's like a communist show, basically. Whereas I look at it as, like, Joy occasionally says something that I don't totally disagree with. And that's really about as far as it goes. It's very much a sort of regular establishment Democrat view from the Obama years, that sort of thing. Two or three of them are going to have that. And then Meghan McCain is going to give a sort of quasi-never-Trumper kind of ignorant view of what right-wingers are saying. And that's about it. If anything, I blame her, because she's there to sort of fill the position of the person on the right, and clearly few on the right have any interest in her as an avatar of their position.
Right. There's a unified anti-Trump sentiment, I guess. Now, I have to confess to not watching The View, but I've seen it a number of times, and there's a unified anti-Trump feeling there, and that's true.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a pro-Trump thing that is missing, and that's what these ladies are doing. But I think for the most part, and I think most Americans, John, would think that they're to the left on The View, even though there's a different version of the left once you're within the left. And I think that that's how it's perceived, and that's why they're going after this. But I just don't see the response as something that's really being clamored for, because Fox News exists every day.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, they already have multiple programs that, like, what was the 5 harshly critical occasionally of Donald Trump?
Yeah.
Is that, I don't watch it. It's possible that it is. I sort of doubt it. What is Fox and Friends, if not The Right View?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, the 5 is the View. I mean, that is
that
the
was
right
what
view.
It was meant to be. Yeah.
Right. I know. But that's what it is. And I don't know that that wasn't what it was meant to be. I mean, you have 5 people up there. It's called The 5, and they're speaking around a table the same way The View is. It's sort of view adjacent anyway.
Yeah. Does it broadcast at 5?
I don't know. No, I don't think so.
Yeah,
Dave Kohler used to watch it. Little secret.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to use that against him someday.
Yeah.
Anyway, Michael, as always, thank you so much for joining us and helping us get through the morning. We do appreciate it.
I love doing it, guys. Thanks.
Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your day on Twitch, Michael.
Yeah, I'm going right now.
Yeah. See you soon. The Trump administration rightfully has received the lion's share of the criticism for what they've done and what they haven't done during this pandemic. But there's criticism to go around because seemingly no one in a position of power to actually do something to assist the American people during this pandemic seems to take it as seriously or seems to understand the nature of the struggle of working Americans in the way that they should. And joining us now to discuss some of the issues that have cropped up in recent relief bills that have been proposed, the author and campaigns manager for Equal Citizens, Adam Eichen, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me, John.
Good to have you here once again. We were talking before this video, and I said that you've been busy, and one of the ways that you've been busy is you've started, you've co-founded a new organization, right?
That is correct. A couple friends and I started the Democratic Policy Center, and the idea is that we are focusing on progressive reform, and we essentially wanted to create a war room in this crisis to perpetually advocate for reforms across all issues that will benefit the American public, whether that be Medicare for all, expanding voting rights, or making sure that corporate influence is taken out of Washington, D.C., which, as we'll talk about, corporations had quite a bit to be happy about in the HEROES Act.
Yeah, they've got people in the room as that's been put together. So what was the starting point for launching the organization? What led you to want to do that?
So we were in talks about forming the Democratic Policy Center for a while, and then we got wind that there was an effort, a bipartisan effort in Congress before the HEROES Act was released on a standalone bill, H.R. 6697. And what it would do is it would extend the PPP eligibility, so forgivable loans, free money, to 501c6 organizations. So those are trade associations. Those are, industry groups that their entire DNA is to influence policy for business interests. Mm-hmm. And again, this is money that was supposed to be for small businesses, and they were extending it to trade associations. And so the cap in the House bill was any C6 organization with fewer than 300 or fewer employees would be eligible. And we thought to ourselves, well, how many C6 organizations have 300 or fewer employees? And we ran the numbers, and it was 99.8% of them. and that included groups like AHIP, the one of the top insurers for the health insurance lobby, Pharma, which is the major drug manufacturing lobby, and it also even included the trade association for the Koch brothers, Stand Together Chamber of Commerce. So this bipartisan bill would bail out some of the largest trade associations, lobbying groups in Washington, D.C.
Well, it seems like it's a significant error to base it almost solely on number of employees when these aren't employers in the traditional sense. They have a certain number of lobbyists that they need. They keep them employed. But in terms of the money backing this organization, it's difficult to come up with a set of groups that are better funded than these trade associations. So it seems like there should be some sort of further consideration before making huge quantities of money available to them.
Right. That's exactly right. And frankly, I just don't think that they did their homework in this. I mean, the vast majority, and I'm talking the vast, vast majority of C6 organizations have like 20 or fewer employees. Mm-hmm. Right. And so to set the bar at 300 is really the only purpose. It's either just negligence or an explicit attempt to bail out, these massive corporate lobbies, which again, their entire purpose is to block progressive change.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the lobbies that are fighting against Medicare for all. But here's the thing, John, is that standalone bill had some legs. It has 99 co-sponsors.
Wow.
But then we got the text of the HEROES Act, and there was a little bit of grumbling about, Nancy Pelosi and House leadership wanting to do something similar. But when the text came out, we dug into it, and somewhere in the hundreds of pages of the omnibus, we found that not only was the C6 bailout in there, it was worse than the standalone.
How was it worse?
Well, any nonprofit would qualify regardless of number of employees. It would include in the original draft 501c4 organizations that were politically active, so-called dark money groups. So like Americans for Prosperity, the Koch Network group, and as well as any of these C6 organizations. And better yet, it would allow, it would designate 25% of the remaining funds, of PPP funds for nonprofits, and half of that money would be assigned to any nonprofit with 500 or fewer employees. And get this, 99% of trade organizations qualify for that money because they have 500 or fewer employees, including, of all people, the Chamber of Commerce, which is maybe the largest corporate law group, and is a perpetual opponent of any sort of center-left change, yeah, let alone progressive change. I mean, yeah, they're one of the kind of the most heinous groups in D.C., and they're going to get, you know, they're going to be competing against small nonprofit. They're considered a small nonprofit under the, yeah, House bill. And we raised the alarm about this. And, you know, we did win some concessions. They added, they struck the eligibility for dark money groups, so politically active C4. So that was bold. A small victory. Yeah, small victory. And it also makes sure that no money can cover registered lobbyists, John. But here's the thing. These organizations, in their DNA, is to influence policy.
Yeah.
So even if you're not covering the expenses of lobbyists, they're still lobbying groups, and you're still opening up additional, you know, money. You're still covering certain expenses that then will open up more of their own money for covering their lobbyists.
Exactly.
So the entire bill is just asinine. Crazy.
Has Nancy Pelosi or have anyone in Democratic leadership been asked about how the standalone bill transitioned to its inclusion in the HEROES Act? Why it still has, you know, these super loose provisions that will allow some of the groups that you mentioned to receive funds?
No, I mean, to my knowledge, no, they haven't gone on record defending this. And I think that the reason is it's very hard to defend it. In fact, I don't think there is a justification. Again, I think they didn't do their homework. And I get it. It's a big bill, but it's absolutely outrageous that we'd be bailing out the Chamber of Commerce of all groups when America, you know, millions of Americans have lost their health care and their jobs. This is not the time to bail out the Chamber of Commerce and these other trade associations that, again, have endless wealth. I mean, they can access endless wealth, and they have in the past. I mean, you know, groups like AHIP were really instrumental in trying to launch a campaign and run the campaign against Obamacare a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Again, these are not friends of the Democratic Party. And the troubling thing, John, is that there's also movement in the Senate, bipartisan movement in the Senate, for this same idea. At least 22 senators have signed a letter asking for PPP eligibility be extended to C6 organizations. So it's still very much in flux. But the thing is that I think that this position is this idea is so vile in some respects, mm-hmm, in given the current crisis, that by raising the issue, I think we have a chance to actually kill it.
Yeah, I hope
because
so.
I just think it's not defensible.
Yeah, and you know, I wonder early on when it was found that some like I think Ruth's Chris Steakhouse got some money, like there was public backlash to that, and supposedly the money was given back. There were a few cases of that. Is that what we're hoping for at this point? That if we talk about it in the media, if you're an organization, makes a big stink about it, that maybe we can shame them into modifying the bill? Is that sort of the strategy?
I mean, that's certainly what we're going to try and do. I mean, I think that, what we want to do is we want to really raise a ruckus around this. We want to say that this is absolutely inexcusable in the current crisis to bail out these corporate lobbying groups. And so, you know, we want to launch a campaign of people across the country, especially in districts where the members of Congress or in the states where there are senators who have sponsored these bills or expressed support for this idea. We want to run an LTE and op-ed campaign. We want to raise this issue. We want media outlets to cover it, because I know there's a lot of attention being paid to the many other aspects of the HEROES Act. And especially given this crisis, there are many, many, many horrible things to be reporting on that are essential for the public good. But this is a real inexcusable provision that I think that, you know, if we shine some sunlight on it, we might actually be able to kill it. And if it goes through, then you're right. Maybe we have to shame some of these trade associations and say, you're not a small business. The Chamber of Commerce isn't a small nonprofit. The American Petroleum Institute is not a small nonprofit. You know, and again, you know, we have to shame some of these people who have put their names onto this bill. You know, the list is online for HR 6697. I mean, for example, Joe Kennedy, who's trying to challenge Progressive Senator Ed Markey. Yep. Why is his name on the bill? Someone should ask.
I think we know. But yeah, I ask anyway, but I think we understand exactly why he would back something like that. And in addition, you have a petition online right now on the website for the group, correct?
Correct. And we're going to be, you know, launching more petitions. We're going to be trying again to sound the alarm as this develops. I mean, this is a pretty arcane subject, but the ramifications are big.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're here to, you know, we're not really taking a salary right now. We just kind of founded this because we wanted to fight back. And so we're just, you know, volunteering at this point to use our expertise to interpret these laws and explain their ramifications. Yeah. And so anybody who's interested in following our work, signing up for our newsletter, signing the petition, just staying up to date, you can find us at DEMPolicy.com, and you can find us on Twitter. We're pretty active there. Awesome. But I really do think, John, that, you know, this is so indefensible that I think we can kill it.
You know, I certainly hope so. And I hope that we can do so before the huge quantities of money start flowing out and we need to start targeting individual groups. Target the bill right now. Target the people pushing it, hopefully. And thank you for your work in this area, helping to raise awareness about it.
Thanks, John. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.